This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Solid Green Radio, where we'll take off our gardening gloves, ladies, to ask some tough questions for difficult times. Right here on Green 960 AM in lovely San Francisco. Will oil run out in time to stop the fires, the floods, the storms of climate disruption? Should people flee states that depend on coal power? Is solar power just a minor amusement? And will it work in cloudy places? You know, I love a good British voice. They always sound so authoritative. Our guest today, Jeremy Leggett, is a real authority. As a geologist, he could have made it big time in the oil and gas industry. Leggett advised the likes of Shell and British Petroleum, but then made the unlikely jump across the aisle advising Greenpeace International. I remember a sense of awe when Leggett showed up at oil and gas conferences in the 90s, explaining that further exploration was pointless. With the advent of climate change, sooner or later, fossil fuels would be limited, maybe banned. Jeremy went out on his own, founding a solar power company in Great Britain, the last place you'd think of sun power. We'll ask him why. Welcome, Jeremy.
Thank you.
Well, as a young geologist, you had research funding from British Petroleum and Shell, and then you tossed the prospects of a very well-paid career to advise Greenpeace instead. Why did you leave the oil industry?
Well, it was at a time when concern was growing among atmospheric scientists that we were heating up the atmosphere because of the known heat-trapping ability of the greenhouse gases. And that was something that I suppose had just never occurred to me. I think culturally, you grow up in things that where there are cultures that avoid risk, and that's still going on today in the oil industry. But I'd done research on the history of the oceans. I knew a little bit about the climate system, as it were, from the bottom up, and what can happen over geological periods of time. And I became very quickly worried about climate change, and sadly, what's happened in the subsequent couple of decades has done little more than fan that concern.
Well, when I first heard about you in the mid-1990s, you were going to oil industry conventions warning that carbon damage to the atmosphere made further exploration pointless. And at the time, the idea of leaving fossil fuels in the ground seemed scandalous, almost mad. Do you still say that?
I think, and the difference is, of course, I'm not there are many people now saying that kind of thing, and particularly about coal, and coal is the real problem. I do think that we face some issues with now, with the speed at which we can feasibly retreat from oil, and we don't want to risk wrecking our economies and leaving ourselves in a situation where we can't deploy the survival technologies that we know we must turn to eventually. Renewable energy and energy efficiency. So the real issue is coal. There's a lot more of it than there is of gas and oil. And of course, we daren't burn some of the more plentiful unconventional oil and gas deposits like the Athabasca tar sands that can be turned into oil and the methane hydrates, which can release vast quantities of methane into the atmosphere. But we do need to maximize the use of conventional oil and protract as long as we can the time when we can rely on that substance while engaging in a very rapid retreat towards energy efficiency and renewables. And these are technologies that are not called renewable for nothing. They are not finite in the way that oil, gas, and coal are.
Well, I wish we had time to go into your insider look of the international climate negotiations, but we'll let listeners get that from your book, The Carbon War, Global Warming, and the End of the Oil Era, published by Penguin. Instead, let's fast forward to 2005 when you put out a new book on peak oil. Can you tell us about Half Gone?
Half Gone was an effort to try and popularize this peak oil argument, which is still a minority concern of people. And there's a lot of whistleblowing going on in and around the oil industry, but it often tends to be by folk who, you know, are writing for their peers, who don't try and summarize things in ways that are easily understood by lay people. That's what I wanted to do with Half Gone. I tried to make it a book that will be comprehensible by people who don't have a scientific background. And there's no primary research in it. There's plenty of primary research by others, including now, of course, the International Energy Agency. But my effort was to popularize the subject, and I've continued that work with a UK industry task force. There are now a number of companies in British industry who are concerned about the peak oil issue. We have a task force that's done one report and working on a second.
And there's that never-ending debate about whether peak oil could help save us from catastrophic climate change. What have you learned about this interrelationship since that book came out?
I think the jury is very much out. The good news is, of course, that the renewable energy markets are now some of the fastest growing markets in the world, and the economic stimulus packages on both sides of the Atlantic are pushing people more towards energy efficiency than might have been the case otherwise. But equally, there are many people who are retrenching into carbon. So Shell, for example, is going all out for the tar sands in Canada, and coal to liquids. Liquid hydrocarbons can be produced from coal, albeit with many greenhouse gas emissions. So it's not clear who's going to win this battle of ideas, but it's very clear from my perspective who has to win it.
Well, Shell and BP have been talking green for some time. I mean, they even call themselves Beyond Petroleum, but they've been doing very, very little. I was really disappointed when Shell backed out of that giant wind farm proposed offshore to help power about a quarter of London, they said. So they raise these big hopes, and then they go back to the dirty carbon every time. Do you think that's really going to change?
Now, I don't. I was optimistic for a while. I think BP played a major role in getting people to take climate change seriously. They were the first major carbon company to split from what was a universal lobby around the time of the Kyoto Convention in 1997. But they have retrenched, gone back into carbon now, and I think it's even worse in a way, because, for example, the other day the chief executive of BP said that in his opinion, solar photovoltaics would never be economic, would never be competitive with fossil fuel electricity unless there was a technological breakthrough. Now, this is a bit like the famous quote from the leader at IBM who said he thought there'd never be a market for computers, or maybe just a market for a couple of computers. Because the analysts in the investment banks are saying, you know, that in their opinion, solar electricity is going to be as expensive or as cheap, the same price, as conventional electricity, in most industrialized markets within just a few years of now, and already is at the same price in some markets where the electricity price is higher than normal.
We're speaking with Jeremy Leggett, author, scientist, and energy professional in Great Britain. And he isn't just writing about global problems. He's now launched part of the solution. Jeremy is executive chairman of his own solar energy company called Solar Century and a third world empowerment group called Solar Aid. Can we start with Solar Aid? What is that?
Well, it's a charity that we set up with the first profits from Solar Century, feeling that, companies, progressive companies, should play a role in trying to stimulate development and tackling some of the problems in the developing world. We made our first profits in 2006, and we gave 5% of those to SolarAid. It was only a sum of about £35,000 at the time, but the small team that we were able to create with that has leveraged funding from foundations, other companies, that's now measured in the millions of dollars. And we're very proud of what it's doing. It's active in four countries in Central Africa and really is training young entrepreneurs to make and sell ways of generating light at night with solar, so solar lanterns and other pieces of equipment. And, you know, it's a candle for hope, like Solar Century itself. And it helps me a lot with Solar Century because, you know, many of the young people at the company, although it's a fully commercial, venture capital-backed, Silicon Valley-backed solar company, you know, it's trying to conduct itself in a different way. And this is very important to the young people who work there.
Well, I think that solar power in a place, perhaps in Africa, can make a huge difference to things like education. If you've got light at night, it can
sure.
reduce the
yeah.
Pollution of other options, and you don't need these big central companies with massive investments. You can start small and just keep building. It sounds like a good plan.
Well, even organizations like the World Bank, who for so long have clung on to the old model of centralized power plants and grids, they've backed off that now, and they're on record as saying, really, this is the only answer for the developing world. We can argue about, you know, companies that already got grids, but if you don't have a grid and you've got hundreds of millions of people to develop, to bring them a light at night, as you say, the education connection is so important with health and welfare and all the rest of it. Yeah, it's great work to be doing.
Well, I looked up a couple of YouTube videos on your commercial company, Solar Century, and one thing that surprised me is you're pushing solar panels in Britain, a country known for cloudy skies. Is solar power really workable in such northern countries?
Yeah, sure. The fastest growing market in the world is Germany, and you know, they have generally the same kind of insulation that we do here in the UK. It surprises many people to know that if you do the calculation for solar cells of existing efficiency on available roof space from, you know, land registry statistics in cloudy Britain, if we put solar panels on every available roof space, we generate more electricity than this cloudy and electricity profligate country currently consumes. You know, and that shows the potential. Now, would you want to do that? No, that'd be a crazy thing to do when you have so many other ways of generating renewable energy. Solar isn't a magic bullet. It's just one member of the family. But it does show the potential, and I think, you know, it's even better for people in sunny parts of the world, but it does fine for us.
Can you tell us about a couple of interesting solar applications you've been involved in? It might give us some hope here in North America.
Well, we're specializing in Solar Century. We've chosen to specialize in building integrated solar, photovoltaic electricity, and solar thermal. So we make roof tiles and slates and bespoke parts of the building envelope. Now, there are American companies, very fine American companies, who do exactly the same. But right or wrong, that's what we've chosen to focus on here in Europe. We're active in four countries. And it's just a part of the market, and fast growing as the solar PV market is, the building integrated solar photovoltaic market really hasn't taken off yet. So we're hopeful of being able to, you know, be in the front rank of companies that innovate ahead of this wave of innovation that's coming. Right now, most of the growth of solar PV is on ground-mounted systems or simple systems that are attached to large roofs, rather than actually forming the frame of the buildings. And we think as time goes by, that emphasis is going to switch more into the building itself, so that buildings become power plants capable of providing their own electricity and their own heating. And as other companies innovate in energy storage technologies, why, you know, I think the energy company, the energy utility of the future is going to look a very different animal from the one that we have at the moment.
This is Radio EcoShock on Green 960 AM, San Francisco. Our guest, Jeremy Leggett, appears in books, magazines, and television as an authority on fossil fuels, peak oil, climate change, and alternative energy. He's worked them all. I'm Alex Smith. Let's get back to Dr. Jeremy Leggett. I'd like to pick your brain about the recent economic crash and the prospects for alternative energy. As you know, as we all know, the governments in the UK and Europe and here in North America have just handed errant bankers trillions of dollars, more than the cost possibly of converting the world to renewable power.
Yeah.
And now they say, well, we're too broke to help green energy.
Yep.
Some solar and wind projects have been canceled. Is there hope we can convert to green energy even in these tough economic times?
Yeah, you know, hope lives very definitely. If you look at the rate of recovery now in this upturn, whether it's temporary or not, of course, we can debate about that, but the recovery of the renewables technologies is faster than other things. And this is because of two main drivers. If you talk to the analysts, it's about the enduring driver of climate change. More and more people are worried about climate change. Companies as well, in the heart of the establishment, there are real concerns, and therefore that driver stays in place. But also energy security. More and more people are coming to the view, because of peak oil or just the politics of having to import gas and oil from insecure parts of the world, that they're turning more and more to renewables and efficiency. So I do think hope lives, but boy, it shouldn't be this difficult. It really shouldn't.
Well, you mentioned the major companies. There was a collection of companies here in North America, including GE, who publicly backed carbon regulation in the United States. But we've just learned through an industry email released by Greenpeace USA that these same companies, through the American Petroleum Institute, are plotting to derail upcoming climate legislation. They're going to bus people in for meetings, and they're going to get all their sub-energy companies organized against it. Well, and it's pretty hard to take their public pronouncements seriously when we find out they're fighting it through the back door still.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of greenwash about, and it doesn't help. I think there are people who are pretending to go through with some of these measures. But equally, now, if you look at the way it's ingrained into the culture of many companies, it's gone beyond greenwash. In the retail sector here, in Europe, for example, you see that the supermarket companies competing with each other with fairly meaningful and deep emissions cuts programs. And that's something new. You know, I've been in this business trying to argue for action on climate change now for more than 20 years, and I've seen real and pervasive greenwash right across the corporate sector. But now there's important stuff going on, and some of these companies react as much to their own staff as they do to customers. So I think that's something to be hopeful about, not to be overstated, and we have to be really vigilant about the continuing dinosaurs like Exxon and you know, companies who you have to conclude that culturally are never going to change. They're going to go down all guns blazing. But, you know, others are changing a lot, and I think we have to fan those fires of change if we're to have a hope of turning some of these disastrous problems around.
Yeah, I'm hoping we don't go down with them. Well, one good sign, Americans drove 100 billion fewer miles last year, I'm told, and the economic downturn has reduced energy use and maybe even CO2 emissions. I'm wondering, would a lasting economic slump stall peak oil, or could it mitigate the climate crisis and give us a little time to work out other alternatives?
No, I don't have any hope on that front. I think that, the downturn is something that can still involve an awful lot of fossil fuel consumption, because don't forget, you know, the real growth of disastrous emissions now is in India and China. That's where the fastest growth is. And you're going to have to watch those economies collapse to have any sort of hope that emissions are going to change. And even then, I'm not sure they would. The answer, I think, is that we have to accelerate these already very fast growth rates in renewables and efficiency so that they reach tipping points and then take off at the speed of epidemics. And then people see what's coming. They see what the future is, and they want to be in on it. They want to have industries, homegrown industries, that are making hay with these survival technologies. And I think that's where hope is. And we did a little book with the breathtakingly original title of The Solar Century, just published, that tries to articulate a vision of how that could happen. And these are very disruptive technologies. They can invade traditional carbon energy markets very fast. And I think that's what we have to hope is going to happen and angle to have happen. And I think, you know, I'm a cautious optimist. I think that we have more than a fighting chance of doing this.
Last year, I listened to American climate campaigner Bill McKibben speaking to industry leaders in Indiana. This sort of ties into what you're talking about, I think, because 95% of the electricity in that state is generated by dirty coal plants. And I found myself thinking, maybe places like that will have to be abandoned as climate change becomes so visible and so deadly we can't deny it anymore. And locations with renewable energy will become the most prosperous. We'll have to adapt to whatever we've installed. Am I just dreaming there, or would you agree?
Well, I think there will be winners and losers. You know, it'll be like the Toyota. There'll be the Toyotas of the energy sector, and there'll be the General Motors of the general sector of the energy sector. But the great thing about renewables is that they're very diverse, and they can work in all sorts of different environments. So I wouldn't subscribe to the view that because, say, Arizona is really sunny and they're going to get it about solar earlier than other people, and all the solar technology and industry is going to be down there in Arizona, therefore, and poor old Indiana is just going to be left with defunct coal. I think, you know, you're going to be able to see renewables industries spring up in many states in America. And many of these technologies make most sense if you use them, you know, right where they're manufactured. And, of course, here in Europe, countries like Portugal and Spain are saying to developers, you know what, if you want to come and build wind farms here, come build the factories as well. Then we'll give you a license. If you give us jobs for our people locally, you can have a license to come here and make hay with renewables. And I think we'll see more and more of that as time goes by.
As we wrap up, can you give us a website to find out more and anything else you might like to add?
I have a website where I regularly download my own reading and thinking about these issues. It's got the very original title of Jeremy Leggett, all one word, LEGGETT.net. And I really hope that's useful for people. I maintain it with the hope that it'll be useful.
Jeremy Leggett is a geologist, author of several books, and a campaigner on peak oil, climate change, and better solutions. He's a columnist for Sublime Magazine, blogs at the Guardian newspaper, and appears on CNN. Leggett founded Solar Century and Solar Aid. Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
This is EcoShock Radio. All environment, all the time. Get more info on the web at ecoshock.org.
You're tuned to Green 960 AM, KKGN San Francisco. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock, heard every Sunday evening at 10:30. Write me anytime. The address is radio@ecoshock.org. We're just ramping up for the new fall season with more great guests like Jan Lundberg from culturechange.org and author Joe Badgen, a man so sane it sounds like crazy to us. Expect Richard Heinberg on his new book Coal and top scientist Alan Robach, who explains why turning the sky white isn't such a hot idea to stop global warming. I like my skies blue, and I want to keep them that way. Join us next week for Radio EcoShock, and thank you for listening.
Blue skies smiling at me, nothing but blue skies do I see.